On behalf of Torah Motion, I want to welcome you to an introduction to the Apocrypha with Dr. Malka Simkowitz.
Hi, everybody. Thank you very much for being here on this snowy day. I am Malka Simkowitz, and I'm very excited to learn the Apocrypha with you. This is a six-week course, and I am going to open the class by talking about how we're going to be covering an arc, what we're going to be doing in each of these six classes, because the title of this course is a little misleading. The Apocrypha can only really be understood after we explore the world of Second Temple Judaism. And one of the big ideas that we're going to be returning to over and over today and in the following classes is that the Apocrypha is only representative of a very, very small amount of literature that survives from this period. Today and next week, I'm going to be providing an historical overview of the Second Temple period, and then we'll dive in. Before I share the syllabus, the outline of this course, I just want to share a few logistical details with you. I am going to aim to wrap up my lecture at around 10, well, Chicago time is 10:45, 11:45 Eastern. And then I'll try to leave about 10, 15 minutes for conversation. In the meantime, if you have a question, feel free to put it in the chat. I will not read it until the end of the hour. But there are other things you could do here. Of course, you could use the raise hand feature. But I think what makes the most sense, if you have any questions, is to put it in the chat. So I'm going to begin by sharing my screen and sharing an overview with you of what I plan to do over the next 6 weeks. So if you're so inspired, I would recommend purchasing. Of course, I like an academic jerk, I put in my own book. But really what I recommend is a book that just came out a few months ago, edited by Jonathan Kluwans and Larry Wills. And this is the Jewish Annotated Apocrypha. What you see, like all my tissues are bookmarking my favorite passages. So this work just came out a few months ago. And what's amazing about it is the essays. About half of this book is actually essays in the back. Essays about the historical context of the Second Temple period and all kinds of different things. And the commentary to the Apocrypha is unique in this book because it's a Jewish commentary. So they reached out to Jewish scholars to write commentaries and introductions to each of the books of the Apocrypha. And so it really situates these books in a Jewish context, even though the Apocrypha, we'll learn, was preserved by the church and canonized by the Catholic Church. The books of the Apocrypha were not canonized, of course, in the Jewish tradition. So if you're interested, this is easily purchasable on Amazon, and it's very, very good work. So today and next week, we are going to be looking at the history of the Second Temple period. And one of the questions that we'll be thinking about is how do we get from the end of the Hebrew Bible, so that would be what we would call the early post-exilic period. The beginning of the Second Temple period is where the Hebrew Bible ends. So how do we get from the Judean, what we might call religion, although that's a problematic word at this early stage, but how do we get from the world of Judaism in the early years of the Second Temple period to the world of the rabbis in the post-70 CE period? How do we get this transition? Because usually when we, or those of us who've gone to a Jewish day school, we learn Tanakh, we learn rabbinic literature, we have a mental timeline that jumps from the end of the Tanakh, I don't have my Tanakh right next to me, but the end of the Tanakh to the Mishnah, and we collapse about 600 years in between. It's my subjective opinion that these are the most important years in Jewish history because it's during this time that a normative global form of Judaism is created in a way that accommodates all Jews wherever they live, regardless of their access to the temple. And so how do we get, again, from the end of the Tanakh to the beginning of the rabbinic literature? So just a brief overview of what happens during these years is very, very useful to understand this transition. Today, we will also be talking about sectarianism. And the reason why I'm going to start with this, even though the majority of the works of the Apocrypha are not sectarian, the reason why I'm starting with this is because I want to undermine a very common stereotype. And when I ask my students, the stereotype is this: I have Catholic students that I teach at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. I also have a variety of Jewish students that I teach in synagogues and Jewish community settings. And it doesn't matter whether I'm teaching Christians or Jews. When I ask my audience to characterize the Second Temple period, usually I get answers that correlate with one another, whether they're Jews or Christians in my audience. If I say, tell me how, what adjectives would you use to describe the Second Temple period? They will say sectarian, they will say divisive, fractious. Of course, you know, there are different frameworks for this idea. In the Christian imagination, Judaism is on the progressive decline, right? And by the first century, Judaism is a shell of itself. It's obsessive with law. It's lost its ethical core. Not so in the Jewish retelling of this period. And yet there is still a bias that this is a period of infighting, that the rabbis come and save by establishing a normative form of Jewish practice that sort of resolves the problem of sectarianism. This is entirely false. This historical scheme of describing the Second Temple period as sectarian is, I can't say this strongly enough, it's an absolute historical falsity. It is simply incorrect. But we have to understand the sources that speak about sectarianism to really get a sense of why that's not true. And so we're going to do that today, God willing. Next week, we are going to continue our discussion of the Second Temple period in a broad sense. And we're going to do that by discussing the concept of canon, what was considered sacred and authoritative in the Jewish tradition, what was not, and also think about how Jews were perceived by outsiders in the ancient world. And this actually is very, very central to our understanding of apocryphal books, which are outward facing, in a sense, self-consciously depicting Judaism as a religion that has integrity and it contains wisdom that is equal or superior to Hellenistic wisdom. It's only going to be in class three that we get into the real nitty gritty of apocryphal texts. In class three, we'll talk about novellas, which interestingly feature centrally feature women heroines. And we'll talk about why that might be. In class four, we'll talk about the Daniel stories that circulated in a variety of languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and were preserved in the Apocrypha. In class five, we'll talk about what it means to write history in the ancient world and how do you read historical works in the ancient world with a focus on 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. And we'll close with a discussion of wisdom literature in the final class. So this is how I imagine the course. I also am fully aware that many of you will not attend every single course. And so my goal is to make each course stand on its own so that you don't need another, each class stand on its own so that you don't need to attend all 6 classes. You can understand each one and hopefully gain from each one independently. So I'm going to stop my share right now and I'm going to open up the source sheet that I've prepared for today's class. And I'm going to start with a few, did I just share my syllabus again? Hold on 1 second. All right, share screen. Okay. And here I have the recommended. You know what? I see what's happening. I just have to close my syllabus. Okay, now you should see the source sheet for today. And before I get into the sources which discuss sectarianism, I want to give you, like I said, an overview of the Second Temple period. And also lay out a few ground rules for how we're going to approach this material. So you could see this overview. Hopefully when I highlight, you can see it. You know, if you have your hand raised, I would prefer that you save it for the end of the class. So unless it's something that you really need an answer right away. But if you don't need an answer right away, maybe unraise your hand and put your question in the syllabus. Okay, so again,
Everyone was just asking if you could put the source sheets in the chat so that we can make sure that we get the correct materials for the upcoming classes. Thank you. I'll unraise my hand.
Thank you. I don't know who said that, but thank you. I don't know how to put a document in the chat, but what I'm happy to do, first of all, well,
Malka, afterwards you can email them to me and I'll post them.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say my plan was... My plan, which I'm thinking maybe is not the best plan, but my plan was to give you my email address, right? But actually, it doesn't make sense for me to email 184 people or whatever. Right.
We can post them on the Torah Motion website when you send them to us.
Yeah. But anyway, if you have questions or comments about today's class, you could reach out to me. And I'm happy to send this on to the Kelmans and they could distribute it. Okay. So today we're going to do a little bit of history. We're going to look at some sources about sectarian Judaism. If we have time, which we probably won't, we'll look at sources about the Dead Sea Scrolls. But a few logistics that I want to lay out before we get into the nitty gritty. And that is the words which I will not be using in this class. I will not be talking about ancient Judaism. This is a term that comes out of late 19th century Protestant German biblical scholarship. And it's a biased term. You'll see it in some scholarship. If you're interested in reading about this period, you'll see the phrase ancient Judaism. It's a misnomer. There is no Judaism in the Second Temple period, by which I mean the word Judaism is very, very rare. Yudaismos in Greek, Yahadut in Hebrew, very rare. We almost do not see it. We see it only in one Maccabees and four Maccabees. Two Maccabees and four Maccabees. But it's not a word used. The problem really, though, is with this word ancient, which suggests that there is something about Judaism that lies firmly in the past. There is a bias about this phrase. I prefer the phrase early Judaism, which bridges this period with the world of the rabbis. And certainly one of the things I'll argue in the next 6 weeks is that there's more which connects this period. Please mute yourselves if you can. There's more which connects this period to the rabbinic period than which divides it. There's actually a wonderful book. And one of the things I'll also do in the next 6 weeks is try to recommend books to you. There's a wonderful book by Daniel Schwartz called Was 70 CE a Watershed in Jewish History? It's a collection of essays written by a variety of scholars, which argues that we tend to look at the Second Temple period as a siloed period that is really very siloed. Please mute yourselves. But there's a lot which connects. And so if we say early Judaism, then we create a bridge to the rabbinic period. And that's what we're going to try to do today and in subsequent classes. Old Testament, I'm sure you understand and have thought about the problems with this phrase. Of course, it implies that there's a New Testament. I always tell my Christian students, this is a perfectly legitimate phrase for Christians to use. I am not offended by it. I think it's totally appropriate. But for Jews, we don't have an Old Testament, right? Because we don't have a New Testament. We have the Hebrew Bible. But more than that, the Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible are not the same thing. And this is really the key. When we say Old Testament, we're not talking about the Hebrew Bible. First of all, there's a different order of the books in the Christian traditions, and there are many Christian traditions. There's, of course, the Protestant and the Catholic, and even within the Catholic, there are many different traditions. There's Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Western Latin traditions. There are all kinds of Bible-lists, and they order the books of the Bible differently than the Hebrew Bible. So the order is different. The Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi, and Malachi ends with the coming of Elijah. So you can imagine why there was a transition, why Christians in the early Common Era wanted to end the Old Testament with Malachi, because it segues very nicely into the coming of Jesus that we see in the Gospel of Matthew. But of course, in some Christian traditions, there's also the Apocrypha, which we're going to get to soon. So the Old Testament is not the Hebrew Bible. I will not be using that phrase in this course. I will not be using the phrase intertestamental, a period of very, very common phrase. Again, in Christian circles, not so common in Jewish, but of course that implies that the New Testament period, the Old Testament period, this is just, you know, whatever, filler, intertestamental, not a big deal. Just a bunch of stuff that's unimportant that happens in between. I don't like this phrase, not only because it implies the New Testament, but also because it suggests that there's a lack of centrality to this period. And then most importantly, am I going to talk about Jews in this period? My kids go to a school in Skokie, Illinois, just north of Chicago. And this week and last week, they've been learning about the Jews leaving Egypt in the Parsha. And of course, they're not the Jews, they're the Israelites. This sounds like a sort of not so important detail, but we don't really have Jews in the Tanakh. Only the latest strata of the Tanakh in Daniel, in Esther, and in other later post-exilic texts. But at this early stage, we don't have Jews. We have the Bnei Israel, the people of Israel, the Israelites. And I want to be very careful with terminology in this course, because we're answering the question of how do we get to a global religion of Judaism? How do we get to a global religion of Jews, right? We have Judeans in the beginning of the Second Temple period, but do we have Jews? And this is a question that we're going to be thinking a lot about as we read these texts. So when I speak about Jews in Judea, I might say Judean Jews. But this is a question we have to keep in mind. And lastly, this is a course on the Apocrypha, but I have this list of other Second Temple Jewish literature to really emphasize that the Apocrypha is just a tiny, tiny bit of what we have when it comes to Jewish literature in the Second Temple period that's not in the Tanakh. So we have the writings of Josephus. Now, when I write, do you see Malka's writing? You see that? That I misspelled writing?
Yes, you see that.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So I'm going to type in a little bit here. And like I said, you know, I'm happy to send this out afterwards. You can also maybe, I don't know if you can copy and paste on your own. So Josephus is a late first century Judean historian. When I teach Josephus's writings to Jewish audiences, they really, really, many, many people are very antagonistic towards Josephus. He's a traitor. We can't trust anything he says. He's just one big fat liar. Josephus is just, you know, just a puppet of the Romans. Now, again, this is something that we're going to undermine in this class. He is not just a traitor. Josephus wouldn't have spent years and years and years writing a history of the Jews and a defense of the Jewish religion if he didn't feel some kind of Jewish identity at his core. I'll talk about that later in the class, though, because I want to get to our sources. So Josephus writes four major works in the Second Temple, and these are vast, voluminous works that are important not just for Jewish historians, but also for historians of the Greco-Roman world, because Josephus has so much information about what it's like to live in the Roman Empire that is not attested to in other texts. So Josephus writes a history of the Jewish people called Antiquities of the Jews. This is a 20-volume work that begins with the beginning of Genesis. This is his magisterial magnum opus, and he writes in the late 90s CE. Josephus also writes an account of the Jewish War, seven volume work. Now, the Jewish War technically, and he writes this in the late 70s CE, maybe mid, so I'm not going to write late. I'm just going to write 70 CE after the war ends in 73. And the Jewish War, you would think, right, this is the war about the Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire, which begins in 66 CE and ends in 73, right? So 7-year war, the temple falls in 70, but the war doesn't end until 73. You might think that he begins his work in 66, but he actually opens the work in the early first century BCE, because Josephus believes that the war stems out of essentially two centuries of antagonism between the Roman world and the Jews in Judea who live under Roman rule as of 63 BCE. So in any case, this is actually a very, very important work for understanding the whole first century BCE and first century CE and political dynamics that are taking place, especially in Judea. He writes an autobiography called Vita, which means life in Latin. And this is where you might say Josephus needs to be taken with a grain of salt, because like all autobiographies in the ancient world, Josephus has a certain agenda to legitimize himself and at times implies that he's a prophetic voice. So this is a very interesting work. But again, you know, when he says that he prophesied to General Vespasian that he's going to be emperor, again, you know, these are things that historians take carefully. He also writes the first defense of the Jewish religion ever to be produced. And this is called Against Appian. Incredibly important work because it cites what everyone else in the Greco-Roman world is saying about the Jewish people. First systematic defense of the Jewish religion to be produced. Okay, so that's Josephus. Hugely important. We can talk in the Q&A session about why I don't think Josephus is just a hot steaming pile of garbage, but that's for a later time. Philo of Alexandria, also incredibly important around, he's born in around 20 BCE, dies around 50 CE, and writes many, 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 many treatises. Some are biblical interpretation, some are philosophical treatises, some are historical accounts of Jewish life in Alexandria. I'm not going to say so much about Philo right now, but his writings are voluminous. You have to keep in mind, Josephus and Philo are both preserved by the church. This is important because the rabbis do not cite Josephus and Philo, and so many have dismissed these writers as liminal, marginal to the sort of broader framework of Jewish history, stretching from the early Second Temple period through the late rabbinic period. And I would argue that just because the rabbis do not cite these figures, it doesn't mean that they are liminal. In fact, they're hugely important for us in terms of understanding Judean and Diasporan life in the late Second Temple period. Very, very valuable sources. The New Testament I'm writing is a Jewish text, but it's a Jewish collection. And there are some authors in the New Testament that probably were not Jewish, but I'm saying, broadly speaking, as a collection, I would label this as Jewish. Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, is very, very Jewish. Luke may have been Jewish, although that's disputed. John was not. Mark, probably not. But again, Paul, very, very Jewish. So I'm sticking that in there. Why? Because the texts that were collected by the early second century C and canonized in the New Testament were read by Jews as Jewish texts. So even if the Gospel of John is not Jewish, and John chapter 8 calls Jews the children of the devil, these collections, these writings were read by people who viewed themselves as Jews. That's significant. Moving on. So already you're getting a sense of the Second Temple period is not just the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is a teeny, 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 tiny part of what we have. And what we have is a teeny, teeny, tiny part of what was written. Because you can imagine if all this was preserved or discovered over 2,000 years, imagine what was produced and never found. Jews were writing and writing and writing and writing. The Dead Sea Scrolls, my enemy. So if you've heard me teach before, you will have heard me say that the worst thing to have happened to the Second Temple period is the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the reason is, I only see Susanna Levin, so I'm going to point you out because I love your facial response to that. I hope it's okay that I said your name. I don't see anybody else. So the reason is because the Dead Sea Scrolls got so much face time in the public sphere, and they represent a community of maybe 100 people who are not only sectarian, but an extreme community within a sectarian group, people read the Dead Sea Scrolls as representative, and they're not representative, right? It's like taking a very, very extreme, you know, like the people who lived in Waco, Texas, like the cult of David Koresh, and say, oh, you want to learn about American life? Like, let's read the writings of David Koresh. Maybe that's not a fair example, but you're talking about a very, very extreme group of Jews who withdraw from Jerusalem life because they deeply believe that the temple administration is run by corrupt apostates. And they retreat from public life because they believe that everyone outside of their community is not the true Israel. And that ultimately they're working towards a clash of major proportions that will herald in the Messianic Age, in which only the true Israel, i.e. their community, will be recognized by God and benefit from salvation. So you're talking about a quite an extreme sectarian community. Now we have over 900 distinct texts discovered in the caves of Qumran on the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea. You're talking about a massive, massive number of texts. And that's a goldmine to understand the world of the sect. It is not necessarily a goldmine to understand the world of Second Temple Judaism. So we have to know how to look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we have to know how to put them in conversation with other texts, especially when we get to the Apocrypha. Most of the books of the Apocrypha were wildly popular. Wildly popular. And how do I know that? Because they were circulated in different languages. And when you see a text that is circulated, not just in Greek, Aramaic, Hebrew, but Latin, and then later Slavonic and Ethiopic, and as you move into the Byzantine period, all these other European languages, and then by the medieval period, you have all these medieval manuscripts in various languages of the Book of Jubilees, let's say, okay, that is a widely circulated book. All right, but before we get to the Apocrypha, I want to talk to you about the Pseudepigrapha, because this is the most difficult category of all when I talk about Second Temple literature. It's a very difficult category because it's an artificial category. The Pseudepigrapha is ever expanding, and the books of the Pseudepigrapha have no internal relationship with one another. In the late 18th century, a German scholar named Johann Fabricius goes on a journey, a sort of colonialistic project, to go to monasteries and ancient libraries throughout Europe and find ancient texts of religious significance. And as he does this, he finds very ancient texts in monasteries and other places, and he publishes them, and he calls them the pseudepigrapha. The pseudepigrapha means in Greek, falsely attributed writings, because some of these texts had titles that attributed them to biblical heroes. So for example, the book of Baruch wasn't written by Jeremiah's scribe Baruch in the 6th century BC, but was written by a later Jew in the 1st century CE, who was later identified as Baruch. There are many, many such books preserved in the pseudepigrapha. Now, what's interesting is that as these libraries have opened up in the past century and more has been published, the pseudepigrapha has expanded. And now you can easily go onto Amazon and search the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, and you will get the 1984 two-volume edition of James Charlesworth's pseudepigrapha, which has, I think, between 80 and 100 distinct texts, all written between the 4th century BC and the 4th century CE, mostly written by Jews. And they all have some religious significance, but they don't have internal coherence. So there are novellas, there's wisdom literature, there's liturgical texts, there are magical incantations. And they're just sort of slopped into the pseudepigrapha because we don't know what else to do with them. Now, even after this 1984 volume, which is considered very authoritative, there was, I think, 2014, a new volume of the pseudepigrapha published by James Davila, again, D-A-V-I-L-A, you could find this on Amazon, with more discovered texts that, what do we do with these texts? Let's slap them into the pseudepigrapha. So it's an ever-expanding collection of texts. And now we get to our category, and our category is the Apocrypha. So now I'm going to tell you what works are traditionally thought of as being in the Apocrypha, and I'm using the list provided in the table of contents in Wills and Clowanz's book, but I put Jubilees in brackets for a reason, and I'm going to tell you why. Okay, so Wills and Clowanz categorizes the apocryphal works into four sections: law, histories and stories, prophecies, poetry, and wisdom. This is, first of all, debatable. You always have to question genres because the ancients did not think in genre. They did not have these sort of like square boxes. I'm going to write a book today on wisdom. Like, that's not how they thought. So when we think about genre, we have to realize these aren't modern categories. But that's okay. Jubilees was only canonized in certain biblical lists. And so traditionally, it has not been considered part of the Apocrypha. It is not considered part of the Catholic canon list of what they call deuterocanonical works. However, it is sacred in certain Christian communities. Like I mentioned earlier, the Ethiopic Christian community considers Jubilees incredibly sacred. And it was translated most prominently into their language, Ge'ez, G-E-E-Z, because it was considered such an important work. But I'm not going to be spending time on Jubilees because I don't personally consider it part of the Apocrypha if we define the Apocrypha as the deuterocanonical list preserved in traditional Catholic teaching. I see that there are some questions on the chat, and I hope that it's okay if we hold off a bit on your questions. Maybe when I'm done discussing the books, I'll take a break and I'll look at the chat box. Histories and stories, we have a rewriting of the book of Ezra known as 1 Esdras. That's just the Greek transliteration of the book of Ezra. It's a retelling of that book. Greek Esther, which is totally different from the Hebrew version of Esther, because there was, what's interesting is that you might think it's a diasporan work because it's in Greek, but it was produced in Jerusalem by Jews who were concerned about Hebrew Esther and concerned about how Hebrew Esther was being read. Of course, we know the problems with Esther: no God, no law, no ancestral practice, no prayer. But everyone forgets the most important problem with Esther, and that's that it ends in intermarriage. The happy ending is that Esther walks off into the sunset with Ahasuerus. Nobody seems to remember that. I think that's like maybe the biggest issue. But anyway, Greek Esther upends the story completely. The Book of Tobit, which is a wonderful novella, an adventure tale sort of told in the Homeric style of a long journey and lost love and reunion, a wonderful story that we'll get to read in future weeks. Famous Book of Judith, which is very similar to Esther, but actually much more pietistic. And we're going to talk about why Judith was not canonized in the Jewish tradition. We have books of Maccabees, which abound. I didn't put four Maccabees. Well, the JAA, the Jewish Annotated Apocrypha, doesn't put four Maccabees here. It puts 1, 2, and 3 Maccabees here. We'll talk about those various books of Maccabees in future weeks. And we have all kinds of prophetic literature. We have a text that Jeremiah purportedly wrote to the Egyptian Jewish community about how they have to stay fast and adhere to their ancestral laws. We have a book attributed to the scribe Baruch. We have stories about the great diasporan hero Daniel. We have 4 Ezra. Oh, I think that's a typo. I think Psalm is supposed to be Psalm 151. We have an additional Psalm in the Septuagint, in the Apocrypha. I'm going to talk about the Septuagint soon, and additional wisdom books. I should say, because I forgot to say it already, the Apocrypha reflects works that were preserved in the Greek collection of the Bible known as the Septuagint. Most of us know that the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible that Greek-speaking Jews read in the late Second Temple period and maybe even in the early centuries of the Common Era. But what's very important to keep in mind about the Septuagint is that it wasn't produced in one moment in time, in one cultural moment, by one small community. Yes, I know about the Talmudic tradition of the 70 rabbis going into 70 separate rooms and emerging with the identical work. But whatever the circumstances surrounding the production of the Septuagint, you're talking about a late 3rd century BCE work of the Pentateuch, of the Torah. So the Torah, the first 5 books, are translated into Greek in the late 3rd century BC. And then over the next 3 centuries, the Hebrew Bible continues to be translated into Greek at the same time that works of the Apocrypha are being either written in Hebrew and translated into Greek or just being written in Greek. And so this is a messy compositional story. This is messy. Again, the Septuagint is not something that's just produced overnight, right? All the books of the Hebrew Bible plus the books of the Apocrypha produced in a year or two by one person or a group. It's produced over centuries. So the Torah is translated into Greek in the late 3rd century BCE. And then the other Hebrew books of the Bible are translated over time, over a couple of centuries. And the works of the Apocrypha are mostly, but not all, originally written in Greek and then appended to the Greek version of the Bible that Christians are reading in the early Common Era. So that's complicated, but that's what we're dealing with. So the Septuagint does not represent a cultural milieu. We can't read it that way. Just like I would complicate it if you read the Hebrew Bible as representing one specific cultural milieu. We can't do that either with the Greek scriptures. Well, now we're ready to start the course. So there are a few things that I want to say about the historical world of the Second Temple period. But of course, Mrs. Kelman said that she would get the source sheet to you. And I'm not going to read this line by line. I never read anything line by line, but I provide as much as I can for you to look at on your own in your own free time. So I'm not going to simply list everything that happens here, but there are a few broad points that I want to make. I did promise you that I would stop and read some comments to make sure that we're all on the same page. So before we go on, I'm going to stop share and look at some comments. Okay, so these all look like comments that we can discuss at the end. Yeah. Okay, oh, and I can attach a file. Okay, so I'm gonna do that at the end. We're gonna discuss this at the end. Okay, worst case scenario, I'll prepare this so that I can get it to you as a file for next class because I see that I could share it in Google Drive. So it doesn't look very hard to me. Okay, now let's resume. All right, so there are a few things that I want to say about this timeline. The most important being that when the Babylonian exile ends in around 539, 538 BCE, and Persia has taken over Babylonia, and we know the famous story of Cyrus permitting the Jews to return, the Judeans, to return back to the land of Israel, the big struggle that later figures in the Tanakh contend with, figures like Ezra and Nehemiah, is that the Judeans have no interest in going back. They don't go back. A measly 43,000 Jews end up returning to Judea in the early Second Temple period. And so the project of Nehemiah in particular to convince these Jews living happily in exile to return is, I would respectfully call, an utter failure, because the vast majority of Jews do not end up back in Judea. And we have these lists, these name lists in Ezra and Nehemiah, which lists all the people who came back, which reminds me, I always say this, so if you've heard me say it before, just please forgive me. I always use this metaphor. It reminds me of how when I'm at the dinner table with my kids and I say, I look at my daughter Hadar and I say, I'm so, so proud of Ayelet right now for putting her plate away. And of course, Hadar has not put her plate away. So I'm talking about Ayelet, but I'm looking at Hadar. The metaphor is these name lists are not really about the people who returned. They're about the people who didn't, right? I'm so proud of these people who came back to Judea. All these people deserve honor and recognition. But of course, the point is all these other people did not go back. But this actually ends up being very, very significant, I think, in a positive way, because what ends up happening is that Jews are spreading and spreading and spreading in the early centuries of the Second Temple period. And so this is when we see the transition to Judaism in the first half of the Second Temple period, by which I mean that even if we don't have the word Judaism at this early stage, you have a global community of Jews. And how do they stay cohesive? Why do they not assimilate? How do these Jews spreading all over the world, some are staying in Eastern lands, some are going Western lands. By the second century BC, we have Jews in Rome, Antioch, Alexandria. We still have Jews in the Eastern region of the empire. How do all these Jews maintain a cohesive sense of community? There's no email, there's no texting. These trips from one land to another are very dangerous and expensive. Jews were not as mobile, of course, as they are now. And so how do they maintain any kind of sense of cohesiveness? This is, you know, an open question, but I would argue that there are a few things that contribute to a sense of a global community at a relatively early stage. First of all, we have what's called the practice of common Judaism. So wherever you were, if you were Jewish, you would keep circumcision, Sabbath, dietary law. But even more powerfully, you would gather regularly together to read the scriptures. And the scriptures contributed to a sense of common communal memory. And by the second century BC, these Jews living all over the world are deeply, deeply mentally committed to the land of Israel, which is interesting because we don't see them actually going to the land of Israel to move, but deeply committed to a sense that they're part of a global community of people who've all experienced major things that bring them cosmically together in a transcendent way. And so by the second century BCE, you have the majority of Jews living outside the land of Israel who are devoted to the land of Israel. We know that they contribute to the Jerusalem temple financially. We know that they make pilgrimages. We have archaeological evidence of pilgrimage roads that are not wide enough for chariots, but wide enough for people to walk together from all four directions to Jerusalem. We have these pilgrimage roads from all four directions, very, very interesting archaeological evidence. So Jews are going to the land of Israel to make pilgrimages. They're sending money, but they're staying in their diasporan communities. And what brings them all together, like I said, is a common communal memory, and yet there is incredible cultural diversity among these Jews who speak different languages, who are in different settings, right? The Jews in the Western region, such as North Egypt, Alexandria, Rome, Antioch, like I mentioned before, would be in a very different cultural setting than Jews who had remained in Persia, in what would become Eastern regions of the Roman Empire, or Sasanian Persia in the rabbinic period. And this is all incredibly important when we look at sectarian literature, because you're not just talking about a tiny representation of Judean life, you're talking about a tiny representation of Jewish life. I have to pause right now and just ask everybody to mute themselves because I hear an echo. It's a little distracting. I know that I could also mute you if necessary, but please try to mute yourself if you can. Thank you. Okay. So now let's, you know what, I am gonna just press mute. Hold on a second. Share you all. Okay. Ah, much better. All right. Okay. So our best evidence for what sectarianism was and what these sects believe comes, unsurprisingly, from Josephus, who writes about the sects in 3 out of 4 of his works, in his autobiography, Life and Antiquities of the Jews, and in The Jewish War. For Josephus, who critiques the Jews of Judea for intra-Jewish fighting that weakens the Jewish people and makes them vulnerable to Rome, the sects are very, very important, right? If you're writing works which talk about the Roman occupation and then the Roman destruction of Jerusalem and the Jerusalem temple, you're going to want to discuss why the Jews of Judea were weak and vulnerable against Roman authorities. And so for Josephus, the sectarianism occurring in Judea and specifically in Jerusalem is very significant. But as we look at the Apocrypha, we have to keep in mind that these works were written to have broad appeal to Jews really throughout either the Greek-speaking diaspora world or the world of Judea. And for the most part, these are not sectarian documents. But I want to give you a sense of the world of the sects. We only have 5 or 10 minutes left, and so I'm not really going to do any of this inside because I want to make sure that we have time for conversation. I do encourage you to look at these on your own once you get this document. What's interesting, first of all, there are a few things I want to say about Josephus most broadly. He does liken these sectarian communities to philosophies, and that is one of his arguments because he's always self-conscious about a Greek Gentile audience reading his works. He's writing from Rome. He's commissioned by the Flavian dynasty, the emperors who ruled the Roman Empire after Jerusalem falls. So he's always conscious about presenting Jewish life in a way that is digestible and understandable to a Greek-speaking audience, but also a way that argues for the integrity and wisdom of Jewish tradition. And so for Josephus, these are philosophies. And sometimes he even uses that Greek word philosophia, that these sects, we have a negative connotation of that word in the English language, but for Josephus, these groups are actually very sophisticated and don't have that sort of negative, exclusivist sense in the way that we think of sects. Based on the writings of Josephus, it seems likely that sectarianism has its origins in the first half of the 2nd century BCE, probably shortly after the Maccabeans gain independent control over Judea in 164 BC, although some scholars put the origins of sectarianism shortly before the Maccabean success in the war. So the range is either shortly before or shortly after the Maccabeans defeat the Syrian Greeks between 175 and 164 BC. What we know is that, or what there's a scholarly consensus regarding, is that sectarianism comes out of political disillusionment with the authorities of Jerusalem in Judea in the early 2nd century BCE. So that these are at the same time political movements and religious theological movements. And of course, in the ancient world, there's no divide between these categories because what is political is religious. But these groups come out of disillusionment with rulership that these groups perceive as being corrupt. And we could talk about that more in the Q&A. What I want to point out to you before we have conversation is that depending on where Josephus is writing, he defines these groups according to different parameters. So that I'm going to skip his autobiography where he talks about how he experimented with all the sects as a child. And then he decided that the Pharisees, that was the best sect for him. And so he decided to live among the Pharisees. But in Antiquities, in book 13, he defines these lines dividing the sectarian groups according to free will. And he says that the Essenes argue that there's no free will. The Sadducees say that everything is free will and you can determine every single part of your future according to your choice. And the Pharisees take a middle ground. This is very significant because in general, while Josephus has no great love for the Pharisees and often blames them for what goes wrong at the end of the Second Temple period, he also views them as moderates. and as political liaisons with the Roman Empire. So the Pharisees are not extreme. Again, not a sect in the sense that they retreat from public life. In fact, they're at the center of political life, and they're considered the political moderates and the religious moderates as well. And this is very important as we read other sects, other material about the sectarian groups. In book 13 again, but later, Josephus gives more detail about how he defines the sects, not only according to fate and free will, but according to their attitude towards oral tradition, with, of course, the Pharisees developing and accepting the authority of oral tradition and the Sadducees rejecting it. Later, he talks about the theme of resurrection, immortality of the soul, with the Sadducees rejecting these concepts, the Pharisees accepting them. But the truth is, you don't create political fractures according to such esoteric divides. So again, these divisions were real, but you know, I could live very happily next to my neighbor and go to the same synagogue as them and send my kids to the same school as them and interact with them and have differences in opinion on the nature of resurrection. The division has to go farther than these esoteric theological divides. And indeed it does. I'm not going to say so much more about that, but again, these are political groups, and the Sadducees elsewhere in the writings of Josephus are described as political elites who don't have sympathy for the masses and at times even identify with the host Roman Empire, whereas the Pharisees do identify with the masses and have their following and their loyalty. The last thing I want to say, and then I'll break up for discussion, is that there's an incredible amount of description in the writings of Josephus about the Essenes. And he devotes far more time to the Essenes than to the other sectarian groups. And likewise, Philo of Alexandria writes about the Essenes. I'm going to skip Matthew. I'm going to skip the Mishnah. Philo of Alexandria writes about the Essenes and how they live communally, and they sort of live the stoic lifestyle where they have no concept of personal property, and they share all things, and they study pietistic wisdom all day. And Philo has incredible admiration for this community. And so Josephus and Philo write and write and write and write about the Essenes. And the reason why I think that they do this is because the Essenes were lesser known to their audience than the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who occupied important roles in the public life of Judea and the administration of the Jerusalem temple. And so the Pharisees and the Sadducees had a sort of outward facing public role in Jerusalem. The Essenes do not, or less so. And Josephus and Philo assume that their audiences don't know about these groups. And so we have to keep in mind that these groups are not in equal public purview. The Pharisees and the Sadducees are taking a much more public role than the Essenes, but at the same time, the pietism and the communal living of the Essenes is very, very appealing to Jewish intellectuals such as Philo. And I'll end with this lovely little allusion to the Essenes by the Roman historian Pliny the Elder, who describes them as living in the sort of remote part of the world. He says, the Essenei, they live apart from the world. They're marvelous beyond all others throughout the whole earth. They have no women among them. They have no sexual desire. Now, Josephus says, many Essenes marry, but some Essenes do not. And probably the Essenes of the Dead Sea sect, which was an extreme form of the Essene sect, likely were the community that Pliny is talking about, although it's unclear because there are women buried in the cemetery at Qumran. But we think that these were just men who were celibate who lived in the community. That's an open question. Anyway, so Pliny says, money they have none. The palm trees are their only companions. Day after day, their numbers are fully recruited. Why? If they don't marry, they don't have families, because people volunteer to join their communities. They're recruited by multitudes of strangers that resort to them, driven thither to adopt their usages by the tempest of fortune. Thus it is that throughout thousands of ages, incredible to relate, this is very hyperbolic, of course, this people eternally prolongs its existence without a single birth taking place there. And of course, he doesn't talk about the fact that these are pious Jews. But the point is that in the Hellenistic world, living communally, withdrawing from the city, which corrupts, this is a big theme in Hellenistic literature, that the city life corrupts and distracts you from the important things in life, like study of wisdom and philosophy. And these people are retreating from city life and giving up all their physical distractions and materialism. And all they do is they aim to increase their piety. This is like the most admirable thing that you could do in the ancient world. And so there's incredible admiration for this community, so much so that it even reaches the ears of Roman historians who know very little about Judean life in the first century. Okay, so with that, I'm going to stop. Again, you know, I'm not giving you a thorough review of sectarianism in the Second Temple period. What I'm trying to do is to give you a sense of actually the diversity of what's going on in the Second Temple period. And these passages, I highly encourage you to look at on your own, remembering that they're representative of a few thousand people, and you're talking about at least 600, 700,000 Jews in Judea alone. The numbers that Josephus gives us is, he says there are 6,000 Pharisees, 4,000 Sadducees, and 3,000 Essenes. Josephus's numbers are known to have been exaggerated. And so you're talking about a very, very small percentage of Jewish life in the first century. And in the next class, we're going to talk a little bit more about sectarianism. I'll try to speak about the Dead Sea sect as well. And then we're going to talk about canon. This is very, very important when we read the books of the Apocrypha. What does it mean that this is a collection? Were there even concepts of such collections at this early stage? And if we have time, we'll talk about what Greeks and Romans were saying about Jews, because the Apocryphal works in many ways are defensive works, outward facing works, which argue for the integrity of the Jewish religion. Well, we have a lot of messages over here. So I am going to try to get to some over here. Okay. Will it be the same link to go into the rest? Yeah, it'll be the same link, I think. Okay. Please tell us in what language each work was originally written. Yeah, of course, I'm going to do that. But that's a work by work discussion. So for example, you know, Judith is written in Hebrew, when Maccabees is written in Hebrew, but two Maccabees is written in Greek, Greek Esther is written in Greek. So that has to be a text by text discussion. Okay. Yes, that cover of the Apocrypha looks like the Jewish annotated New Testament. Very good, Gidon Ariel asks. Yes, it's a common publisher, Oxford University Press, and they're meant to be a partner volume. So I highly recommend, Gidon Ariel points out that this cover is almost identical to the Jewish annotated New Testament, also published by OUP, Oxford University Press, also with incredible essays in the back and a Jewish commentary. And I highly recommend both of these works. Are very affordable. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay, I am not going to go through all of these, but look, you have my email. You can always send me questions personally. Maybe what we should do is, there are 194 people on this call, but if somebody wants to type in a question that I missed, type it in now, or you could even unmute yourself and ask me. I know that's a little risky because we have a lot of people, but I apologize. I can't go through this. I'll waste your time if I do that. So either unmute and ask a question or type it in again.
Could you post Daniel Schwartz's book again in the chat, the name of his book?
Absolutely. This is an expensive book, I think, but it's a very good book. You can get it in the library. A Large in Jewish History. I'll put in my email again. Name of the second book, Rebecca. I don't know which one you're talking. Oh, Jewish Annotated New Testament, maybe. Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah, yeah. My edition is from the library that I've renewed 3 times. Then I return it and then I take it out again. But the point really of this collection is simply that it wasn't a watershed. It was a catastrophe, right? So 70 C wasn't a watershed. It was a catastrophe, by which I mean the structures were already in place to accommodate the absence of a temple. Jews were using the synagogues for 3 centuries by the time the temple fell. So the structures were in place to what we would call save Judaism, even before the temple falls. So there's more linear continuity than you might think. Question. Why do Christians put Sadducees and Pharisees together? Yeah, because of the New Testament, exactly, right? I mean, somebody also has raised her hand, but yeah, Oh, you're the person who raised your hand. Okay. I don't know how to pronounce your name, so I apologize. You can email me your pronunciation of your name. But if you read the New Testament, they're lumped together. The Sadducees and the Pharisees are the interlocutors of Jesus. But Jesus is living within the world of sectarian Judaism. He's not your average joke. He's living this very specific world that is familiar to us because we are proto-Pharisaic, right? As many of us, not all of us, I'm sure, but many of us might call ourselves rabbinic Jews or living in the tradition of rabbinic Judaism. And Pharisaic Judaism is sort of the ancestral prototype of that. But it doesn't mean it's representative of all Judaism. Okay, I heard you sick into a lecture. Yeah, Josephus gives numbers. Oh, yeah. Okay, so who are these Judeans who are not sectarian? Right, and so that's what we're going to do for the next 5 weeks. Right, so these are Jews who practice what E.P. Sanders calls common Judaism. And this is a great, great seminal book. I think he wrote in the early 90s. But oh my gosh, $235? No, don't buy that. Sanders in the early 90s emphasized something that we all sort of know intuitively, which is that to be a Jew in the ancient world, you kept the big three identifying markers of Jewish law, circumcision, dietary law, the Sabbath, and you gathered together to read the scriptures wherever you were. The synagogues were not instituted for prayer. They were instituted for scriptural reading. And then later in the rabbinic period, that's a place of normative prayer. But the synagogues are places where you read and often interpret the scriptures. And so the average Jew is not a member of a sect. The average Jew is doing these, practicing what we would call common Judaism. If 43,000 return to, oh, so that's a big question. Oh yeah, what about Mikvah? Okay, so Susanna Levin, so we don't know, although Salo Baron has classically done very important work on demographics and numbers of Jews in ancient, ancient Judaism, in early Judaism, you know, conservative, we would talk about 250,000. That'd be conservative, but easily a couple hundred thousand. So you're talking about a lot of Jews who did not go back. And how do I know this? Well, I don't have so much time left, but you know, for sure by the first century, there are 250,000 Jews in Egypt alone. Philo talks of the city of Alexandria, which has five sections. Imagine like a pie, and each section is named after a Greek letter of the alphabet. So you have section alpha, section beta, section gamma, delta, and epsilon. And he says all of delta is Jewish, but there are Jews in all five sections of Alexandria. So if you could estimate how big the city was, and then you estimate 25 to 33% of the city is Jewish, you're talking about a massive amount of Jews, sort of like the Lower East Side or like the New York City of the ancient world. Mikvah, you know what? That's too big of a topic for me to discuss now, but absolutely, mikvah is important. I would not call it part of common Judaism. I would not say that you went to the mikvah and that sort of identified you as a Jew, because it's inconsistent depending on community. So in Judea, you know, archaeological evidence has shown that purity laws are very important, but overstated in the New Testament. So purity laws are important. We have 10 mikvahs found at Qumran. That's a lot of mikvahs for a tiny community. They were using the mikvah. But in diasporan communities, we don't have sort of a correlative evidence that the mikvah was equally important. So we wouldn't call that something that brought all Jews together into this coagulated community. But that's a great question. I wish I had more time to talk to you about that. Weren't the Maccabees also fighting against Hellenism? Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If I don't understand the question there, email me, because you're right. Yes, JA is super affordable. Okay, I think I'm going to wrap up, but you have my email. I'll put it in for